Hi guys, and welcome back to another True Crime and Makeup Time video. Today's case was one I just stumbled across, and all I saw was like a 5-second clip about this case, and I was like, I have to research it. It's a tragic story about a child's life being taken away by a monster for his own selfish needs, and a mother's need to seek justice for her child. I'm sure many of us can relate to this case, so let's jump in. Marianne Bachmeier was born on June 3rd, 1950. She grew up in Sarstedt, which was a small town near Hildesheim, Lower Saxony in West Germany. And her parents had fled here from East Prussia after the Second World War. During the war, many people fled Germany and moved to West Germany for their safety. Marianne's father had been a member of the Waffen-SS, which was the combat branch of the Nazi Party's SS organization, and he was used to a rigid way of life. He was an authority figure and a violent man. And I read that this was quite common. You know, they were dealing with such bad situations in the war and seeing such violent acts that they too became very cold, callous men. Because of this, her father ended up drinking alcohol all the time. He would spend a lot of his time at a bar near their home. And when he was home, he was aggressive and angry, and it just wasn't a happy home and environment to grow up in. And although her parents were quite conservative and religious, her father soon ended up leaving the home, and this caused Marianne's mother to divorce him when she was just little. Her mother wouldn't stay single for long though. She would soon remarry another man just like her father. Another unhappy home. Growing up this way was not easy for Marianne. She described her life as a dictatorship, and she struggled throughout her life, especially during her teen years. Her stepfather was extremely strict, religious, conservative, and he put a lot of rules onto Marianne. On top of that, her stepfather found Marianne to be a difficult child because she had a difficulty following all these rules. Her mother wasn't very supportive and loving, and her father, to discipline her, would beat her and humiliate her. Eventually, her mother felt like it was all Marianne's fault, you know, for the conflict and the issues in the home in their marriage, that Marianne was to blame for all of this. So she would kick her out of their home. Marianne would have to just make it in the world alone. When Marianne was just 16 years old, she would become pregnant with her first child. She felt she was too young and she was not ready to be a single mom, so she gave this baby up for adoption. A couple of years later, she began dating a boy that she met at school. Then at the age of 18, Marianne would become pregnant with her second child with her boyfriend. Now, even though she was 18 and in a relationship at this point, she wasn't really sure about her future with this guy. It was supposed to be different in her mind. She wanted this relationship to work. She wanted to keep the baby. But however, when she was close to giving birth, like far in her pregnancy, she was at a disco and she was assaulted by an unknown man. She was really traumatized by this, and this trauma would enter into her relationship, and her relationship would become rocky. So she decided to give this second baby, a daughter, up for adoption as well. After she finished school, she grew up a little bit. She knew she wanted to change her life. She would have to get a job and find a place to stay. In 1972, when she was 22 years old, she would get a job as a waitress at a bar and restaurant called Tipasa. It was in Lübeck's old town area, and she really didn't mind this job. She didn't mind working the super late nights and then sleeping all day. Soon she began dating the bar manager. His name was Christian Berthold. Christian was the owner of the bar, and he was a hippie but successful in running the bar. And their relationship was filled with affairs, one-night stands. And it's alleged that he may have even raped her when they weren't together. Then Marianne finds herself pregnant for the third time. But this time, Marianne was sure she wanted to keep the baby. She was older, she had a job, she had a place to live, and she felt like she was finally in a position to take care of a child. When Christian found out about the pregnancy, he promised to stick by her and raise this baby with her. But when she was close to giving birth, Christian backed out and said that he was not ready to commit to a serious relationship and Marianne would have to do this alone. So Marianne did. She decided to raise this baby by herself. On November 14th, 1972, Marianne would give birth to her third child, a daughter she named Anna. Soon after the birth of Anna, even though she was happy with her decision to keep Anna, she decided that after this, she never wanted to have any more children. So at the hospital, she was sterilized in a procedure called tubal ligation, which I'm like, damn, you just gave birth. Your hormones are all over the place. And I feel like she probably needed some more time to think about it, but maybe she was just really sure in her decision. At first, in Anna's early years, Marianne was a doting, loving, caring mother. Anna grew up a pretty happy child, but soon Marianne was forced to marry one of her co-workers. He was a chef who would face deportation if he wasn't married, and it was actually Christian who kind of coerced her into this. And I don't really know what happened with this or how it kind of affected them, because it seemed like it was more just on paper, just to have him married on paper, but there was no further information I could find about them, if she was actually living with him or if she ever really had a real relationship with this chef. At this point, Marianne became quite a popular hostess at Tipasa, but her long work hours were beginning to affect Anna. Everyone who worked at Tipasa, as well as the regular guests, knew Anna. She basically grew up at the bar. But the novelty soon wore off. It was hard being a single mom. She went back to work and would take Anna with her every single day. Marianne needed the money. She had to support herself as well as support Anna. But it was also reported that she wouldn't rush back home after her shift at work ended. She kind of would hang around and party a little bit more, leaving Anna to be more displaced. Anna was often alone in the streets while her mom worked at the bar. At one point, Anna's sleep and school attendance had become so bad that Marianne was actually thinking about putting Anna in the care of a friend. She was kind of aware that she wasn't being the best mom. She was thinking about it, and she was actually going to put them with this couple who she thought could probably raise Anna better than she was, but nothing came of it. She was just thinking about it. Anna was known to be a happy and free-spirited child, just like her mom. Due to Marianne's schedule, she often treated Anna like an adult. Anna was forced to be self-reliant from a really young age. It's reported that at times Marianne was quite selfish, that she put her job at Tipasa over her responsibilities as a mom to care for Anna, that she neglected Anna quite a bit. Regulars at the bar would claim that they saw Anna falling asleep on a bench inside the bar while her mom, Marianne, would party, despite their apartment being situated right above the restaurant. Like, basically saying Marianne couldn't even take 2 seconds to make sure her daughter was asleep in her bed, that her daughter was just sleeping in the restaurant. Now, Christian was still the owner of the bar, and Anna knew that Christian was her father, but he wasn't a hands-on parent or a decent partner to Marianne at all. Anna's life was very free, but this isn't the best thing for a child. Anna had no rules. She could do whatever she wanted day and night. She would play outside during the day while her mother slept inside the apartment, and then she would sleep sporadically at night while her mother worked and socialized. Everyone in the neighborhood knew Anna. She would often talk to the neighbors and play with their pets. On May 5th, 1980, 29-year-old Marianne, she was asleep in her apartment that morning, and that afternoon, she had a photo shoot with the local newspaper about the unusual painted-on Volkswagen she owned. Anna was 7 years old at this point, and she was due to go to school that day. But the night before, Anna and Marianne, they had gotten into a pretty bad argument, and they were just not in the best of moods. 7-year-old Anna decided she was not going to go to school that day. She did this despite her mom. She instead decided to spend the day wandering the town, and she actually went to visit a friend's house, but when she got there, this friend had already gone to school. So on her way back home, she stopped by a neighbor's to play with the cat. Once Marianne finished her photo shoot and returned home, there was no sign of Anna. Marianne went to look for her, and when it became dark and Anna was still not home, she reported her missing to the police. But Anna would never come home that day. Maria knew that Anna was possibly pretty angry about their fight from the previous night, and that she was probably hiding out at a friend's house just to piss her mom off. But when all her friends were questioned and nobody had seen or knew where Anna was, Marianne started to grow very concerned. Then, later that afternoon, a distraught woman walked into the local police station claiming that her fiancé had confessed to a horrific crime. He admitted to killing a young girl who sometimes came into their apartment to play with their cat. The girl's name was Anna. The fiancé was 35-year-old Klaus Grabowski. Klaus was Marianne's neighbor. He knew the mother and daughter. He knew Anna. He often spoke with her. He would often let her come into his apartment to play with his cat. The previous day, he bumped into Anna on her way home, and as she often did, she asked him if she could play with his cat. He said yes, and he took her into his apartment where he lived with his fiance, but at the time, no one else was home. It is unknown exactly what transpired in that apartment, but investigators would later learn that Klaus kept Anna in his apartment for hours before he strangled her with a pair of his fiance's pantyhose. It's not confirmed if he assaulted Anna. After he strangled Anna, his fiance returned home, and that's when he confessed what he had done. His fiance immediately left to report this to the police, and once she was gone, Klaus put Anna's body into a cardboard box. He put the box onto his bicycle, rode his bicycle with this box to the banks of a canal, and he buried Anna's body inside the cardboard box in a shallow grave. Klaus Grabowski had a really, really troubled past. He had a history of sexual offenses and assaults against young girls. In 1973, he had sexually assaulted a 6-year-old girl, and she tried to run away. He chased her down, he began to strangle her, and she screamed so loud that he had to let her go. She managed to escape, and he was charged with attempted murder, but he was given probation. And then later in 1975, he was charged with the sexual assault of 2 young girls. In court, he was given a psychological evaluation, which claimed he was addicted to abnormal sexual instinct and that he was considerably limited in his ability to prevent it. So basically, he was addicted to doing sick shit on young girls, and his condition, you know, limited his ability to prevent his actions, which is a joke. But because of this evaluation, he was sent to a psychological treatment facility instead of jail. So then in 1976, while he was spending time in this treatment facility instead of jail, he was given the option to undergo a controversial procedure which would chemically castrate him and then be released into society castrated, or the other option was to remain in this facility and continue treatment. So I actually looked into this a little bit. So offenders at the time who were chemically castrated were treated with this drug called Stilbestrol. Right? And Stilbestrol is a type of estrogen, and the intention is to lower a man or the offender's testosterone levels. So what does lowering testosterone do to a man? So it changes their sex drive, erections, mood, sleep, energy levels, and their muscle strength. So along with this, an antipsychotic drug called benperidol can be used in these offenders to reduce their sexual urges, but it does not affect testosterone levels. So unlike physical castration, where they essentially cut off a man's testes, or I think they can also like cut off blood supply internally to the testes, chemical castration is reversible. And then it's also claimed that this procedure only affects a man's ability to reproduce, and it doesn't actually control their sexual desire or drive. So essentially, it's believed that it doesn't actually do anything to control their urges to commit sex crimes. So Klaus obviously chose the chemical castration procedure because, duh, it's reversible and he gets out of the facility. So he underwent this procedure where he basically takes this medication, and he was released shortly thereafter. Now, even though he underwent this castration procedure, was given these meds, there were no further psychological evaluations done or ongoing treatment or doctor provided to Klaus to continue seeing. He was just released. So 2 years later, Klaus walks into a urologist's office and he's like, hey, I just want to reverse this chemical castration. I want to increase my testosterone. And his goal for doing all this was because he wanted to start a family with his fiance. He had to go through court to do this, and the court granted this reversal. Now, this was because he claimed to the court that apart from wanting to start a family with his fiance, he was having, you know, significant side effects from the chemical castration. I don't know what the side effects exactly were, and I don't really know why the court granted him this reversal. Basically, they were like, oh, yeah, forget about what you did. It just doesn't make sense. He was guilty of sex crimes. Reversing the castration is directly related to the crimes he committed. So in early 1980, he was given testosterone injections and medication to take home to continue his treatment. Now, he also lied to the doctor who was conducting the reversal, stating that he was receiving mental treatment at the time. So this doctor treated him solely for the reversal and didn't look into anything else. At the time of Anna's murder, Klaus's testosterone was at the same level as before the chemical castration. This doctor who treated him did not know of Klaus's past, and he neglected to look into his criminal history. And this would torture him after the death of 7-year-old Anna. When the police arrived at Klaus's home, he had disappeared. He had disposed of Anna's body by this point, and he left a note for his fiance telling her to meet him at a bar later that night to talk. The police instead decided to visit this bar and wait for Klaus to arrive. When he got there, they immediately arrested him. During his interrogation, Klaus did admit to murdering Anna, but his reasons for the crime were shocking and disturbing. He basically said that he killed Anna after she tried to blackmail him. He claims that this 7-year-old girl tried to seduce him and threatened to accuse him of molesting her if he didn't give her money. He claims that he never touched Anna sexually and he killed her due to his fears of being accused of sexual abuse. He was angry and scared that his fiance would leave him, that he would go back to jail. He was scared to lose everything. He said he was provoked and threatened. So as Anna was sitting on a chair inside his apartment, he looked over and saw a pair of his fiance's pantyhose laying there. He decided he was going to strangle her. He approached Anna and wrapped the pantyhose around her neck. In the struggle, Anna fought for her life. She fell off the chair, she knocked it over, but Klaus was much stronger. He obviously overpowered her. He pulled the pantyhose around her neck tighter and tighter and tighter until she was dead. During the interrogation, he guided police to the canal, to the site where he had buried Anna. She was found dead inside this large cardboard box, hogtied. Police immediately could see that this was not a rush job. She was carefully tied. She was carefully placed inside this box. This wasn't a crime done in haste. Klaus took his time. When the police told Marianne about her daughter, she was unable to even react. Police found this quite odd, as Marianne did not even want to know any details about the murder of her daughter. She didn't want to speak to the police. She didn't want to go to the morgue to identify Anna's body. They didn't know how to handle this situation. It was so unusual, something that they rarely came across, but everyone grieves differently. A few days later at Anna's funeral, Marianne declined a traditional religious ceremony and instead played Pink Floyd loudly in the church. Despite her reaction to Anna's death, she was completely destroyed. Marianne had lived a tough life from an early age with many struggles, but Anna's death was something that she would never recover from. She went through a lot of pain. She had multiple meltdowns in public. She locked herself in her apartment for days. Marianne struggled with her actions during Anna's short life, the guilt she faced of perhaps not caring for her a little bit more carefully, for not giving her to that couple who could take better care of Anna, give her more attention and love, for her last moments with Anna being in a fight. The guilt of all of this just ate her up and she could not forgive herself. The trial for her daughter's murder would not take place for several unbearable months. During the trial in March 1981, Marianne was forced to sit there and listen to testimonies and descriptions of her life with Anna, her role as a mom, that she worked and partied late into the night and slept during the day when she should have been caring for Anna, that Anna practically grew up in the streets, that Marianne did not care adequately for her own daughter, that when Anna was alone, she would often skip school and talk to those around her, that she met Klaus when she was alone one of these times and would talk to him, perhaps someone she shouldn't have been in contact with unsupervised, the man who killed her. Marianne was heartbroken, but angry. During the trial, Marianne sat in the front row of the courtroom staring at Klaus, the man, the monster who murdered her daughter. She often made loud comments during the trial, and at one time she even shouted, "Say something, you pig," because he was being questioned and he was not answering and she just couldn't hold herself back. Witnesses in the court kind of hated on Marianne, someone who was grieving, who lost a young child in a horrific way. They claimed that she liked the attention and that's why she was loud and dramatic in court. But I don't even know how people can make those kinds of comments. How hard must it have been for Marianne in that courtroom watching the man who killed her daughter sit there, be questioned about what he did to her? I mean, it's wild to me that she was hated on when she was a victim. How difficult it must have been to hear Klaus reliving her daughter's murder. When asked how she died, he said, "I heard something come out of her nose. I was fixated. Then I could not stand the sight of her body any longer." The urologist who performed the castration reversal on Klaus was called forward to answer as to why he performed this procedure on Klaus without doing his due diligence. Klaus had apparently told this urologist that he was castrated by the court because he was an exhibitionist. He would flash everyone, not that he was castrated for committing sexual crimes against little girls. That doctor should have really followed up on his claims, given that not everyone was being castrated left, right, and center. It was an unusual procedure. He should have verified the reasons for Klaus's. Christian even tried to sue this doctor for negligence, but was unsuccessful. The issue for castration as a measure to prevent offenders from reoffending became a big topic in this case. Was this a good option to prevent sex crimes? The fact that these offenders even have an option to reverse? Was this a good way to prevent sex crimes? The fact that offenders have this as an option for release rather than castration being a punishment, it's almost like a way out. Like, well, you can stay here and be locked up and receive treatment, or you can just take this chemical castration and just be free in the world. Obviously, they're going to choose that. And then the fact that these castrations can be reversed once they're released and allowed to live normally, I mean, even though they have to go through a court to get this done, it seems like they could just go to any doctor and lie about it and get it reversed. How would you even know? No one even checks up on these offenders. There's no further treatment. It's really stupid. On the second day of the trial, a police officer was describing how Anna was found, the scene of the crime, how she was hogtied inside that cardboard box. It truly was shocking. It was apparently during this where Marianne misheard a conversation between Klaus's lawyer and the judge. Marianne thought that the next day in court, Klaus was going to be giving his version of events. Marianne already knew what Klaus claims to have happened, that Anna tried to blackmail him for money, and she could not stand it. Marianne had a tough life. She was raised by an abusive and violent father, an abusive and violent stepfather. She was raped and sexually assaulted by the men in her past. There was no chance Marianne was going to allow Klaus to lie about her dead daughter. She was not going to have it. On Friday, March 6th, 1981, it was a cold and rainy day 3 of the trial. Marianne walked into the half-empty courtroom before it was open to the public, so there weren't many people there. 5 minutes before the court was in session, Klaus was led into the courtroom from a side door and taken to a seat. He was seated with his back towards the entrance of the courtroom. Marianne walked in and made a comment about how many people there were. Her friends who were with her told her maybe she should just wait outside for a few more minutes. Marianne sort of agreed. She turned her back, began walking towards the entrance exit, and then she turned around again and began walking straight towards the front of the courtroom. She walked right over to where Klaus was seated, just a couple of meters away from him. She then pulled out a .22 caliber Beretta from her purse and aimed the gun at Klaus's back and opened fire. She fired 8 shots, 7 of which hit Klaus in the back. He slumped over onto the desk in front of him, then slid down and fell on the ground, dying minutes later before help could arrive. Marianne threw the gun to her side and allowed police to restrain her without a fight. At this point, she repeatedly said, "I wanted to shoot him in the face. Unfortunately, I hit him in the back. I hope he's dead." Anna's father, Christian, who was present and witnessed the incident, stated, "She did it. She actually did it." Unfortunately, Klaus died without being proven guilty. So technically, he died an innocent man. Overnight, everyone knew who Marianne Bachmeier was. This became one of the most famous cases of vigilante justice in Germany. She was known as the Revenge Mother, and pictures of her face were plastered all over the media. Many people supported her actions, especially people with children who claimed that they would have done exactly the same thing. Some even said that what she did to Klaus was not enough, that he deserved to suffer more. Marianne's revenge on her daughter's killer and subsequent prosecution and trial that followed caused a support association to be formed for her. And within a week, 100,000 marks had been donated in support of Marianne to fund her trial and her legal fees. Marianne was released soon after being arrested, but then a few months later, she was arrested again due to being a flight risk. While awaiting trial for over a year, Marianne tried to take her life over 5 times. She refused to cooperate with the psychologists of the court and was forced to remain in a psychological facility until trial began. The trial was highly publicized and Marianne's face was all over the news. The bar to Passa was scrutinized and Marianne and Anna's life together was just a subject of scrutiny. The court had to prove if the murder of Klaus was premeditated or not. Due to Christian making that statement, you know, she did it, she actually did it, it gave investigators an idea that Marianne possibly planned the entire attack. It wasn't a mental break and psychosis that caused her to kill Klaus. It was found that prior to the trial, she bought this gun and practiced her aim in the cellar of the bar to Passa where she worked. Marianne denied this. She said she bought the gun for self-defense, that she feared for her life. She denied practicing with the gun. However, she was a very accurate shot. They stated she was able to remove the gun from her purse, turn the safety off, and take multiple shots at Klaus with no issues. Experts believe she must have had some prior knowledge or practice shooting a gun prior to the trial due to her demeanor during the crime. Marianne's defense claimed that her actions were spontaneous, that she believed Klaus was going to be telling more lies about her daughter, provoking him. But the prosecution went on to say how Marianne was such a bad mom and why would she want to seek revenge for the death of a child that she didn't care for. It was a pretty shitty attack on her, I must say. Although many people, majority women, supported her and she became kind of a celebrity. In the end, on November 2nd, 1982, Marianne was charged with manslaughter and sentenced to 6 years in prison. The prosecution was shocked, but the judge found it suitable because he was convinced it was an act of rage caused by trauma of her daughter's murder. I'm convinced he just agreed with her actions and he was like, I would have done the same thing. So that's why she was only given 6 years in prison for murder, essentially. Marianne spent the first 18 months of her sentence in a psychiatric facility, and then after 3 years, she was released as a free woman. Marianne never showed remorse for her actions, and I don't know why anyone wanted her to. She clearly felt she did the right thing, and some felt that her sentence was too harsh, and some felt that it was too light. And this is so similar to the Gary Plouchet case I did a few years ago. If you haven't seen that one, that's another parent revenge case, and people always compared the two. Marianne did a few interviews after being released from prison. She stated that she could not bear hearing Klaus tell one more lie about her daughter, that shooting him was not about revenge. She just wanted it to stop. She says that if he had apologized, been remorseful about the crime, that she couldn't imagine shooting him, but he wasn't remorseful at all. Marianne later moved to Nigeria and married a German professor. She didn't want to stay in Germany and live the rest of her life only as Anna's mother, which kind of makes me sad. And I understand her trauma, but no matter what, I would never want to not be known as my kid's mom. But, you know, you wouldn't understand her psyche unless you were in her shoes. Eventually, Marianne and her husband would get a divorce and Marianne would spend the majority of her life in Sicily as a caregiver. But when she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, she moved back to Lübeck, where a reporter filmed the last weeks of her life in a documentary. On September 17th, 1996, Marianne passed away at the age of only 46 years old, and she was laid to rest in the same grave as her daughter, Anna. She actually wanted to be buried in Palermo, but was laid with Anna instead, seemingly against her wishes. This case has no happy ending, apart from the fact that a sick monster named Klaus also did not have a happy ending. Was there justice in this case? It seemed like Marianne was cursed in this lifetime to have no happiness, which passed on to her daughter, Anna. Apart from the short moments of joy that Marianne and Anna had together, it really is a very tragic, sad life for the both of them. She does have two more daughters, I believe, living in the world today with other families, and hopefully they are living happy lives. What do you guys think of this case? The idea of a mother seeking revenge for their child is understandable to me, as I'm sure many of us would do the same. But I feel like your life is lost the moment your child's life is. And that's why I can never understand how these parents go on when the worst happens to their children. Let me know your thoughts on today's case down below, guys, and I will see you in next week's video. Besitos. Bye.